Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. We live in unique and highly uncertain times. Rate and FX markets, especially in the developed world, are experiencing volatility at levels associated with crisis. Central banks are confronting an inflation problem not seen in decades and risk doing too much or too little. And the intersection of market prices and geopolitics is especially fraught. Against this backdrop, it was a pleasure to welcome Hugh Hendry to the Alpha Exchange. The founder of Eclectica Asset Management, a fund he ran from 2005 to 2017, Hugh is now a developer of high-end properties. But he's also spending a lot of time reading, thinking, and reflecting. Our discussion reviews his time in asset management and his focus on original uncorrelated trade construction, while sharing some of his success in spotting convex trade opportunities where the consensus broke. He also looks back on the long cycle of post-crisis QE as a vol suppressor. With respect to the set of risks today, Hugh is keenly focused on China and presents a sobering analysis of vulnerabilities associated with an overvalued property sector, as well as foreign exchange adjustments. On the latter, he believes a cross rate that should be watched is that between the Japanese yen and Chinese yuan. Lastly, in contemplating extreme scenarios of what if, Hugh sees value in an extremely long-dated, far out-of-the-money call on the S&P 500, a trade that could be explosive in a regime in which inflation, rates, volatility, and nominal asset prices surge. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Hugh Hendry.
My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Hugh Hendry. He is the founder of Eclectica Asset Management, a hedge fund that ran for 15 years and currently devoting a lot of his time and attention to financial podcasting. Hugh, it's great to have you on the Alpha Exchange today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
We are having this conversation amidst a historic couple of days here in markets, and perhaps this was an exercise in building towards an intensification of risk, but as of course we all are staring at the back end of the UK gilt market, we're looking at the British pound. So there's a lot going on in terms of developed market FX and rates volatility. And so we'll have plenty to talk to about how we got here, what the implications are, and where we might be going forward from here. But Hugh, I wanted to start backwards and go back and do a little bit of history just with respect to you. You're a very popular commentator and someone who's shared a lot of his thoughts throughout the years on risk events, on broad macro themes. And so let's kind of start backwards and have our guests learn a little bit more about you and just how you developed your keen interest in geopolitics and the intersection of geopolitics and markets. Tell us about the early days for you in terms of career development and how you got your start.
Well, I intend to be brief. I think a lot of people have heard the story. And like you say, the present theater of markets is so just darn kind of exciting that I think we would like to miss that opportunity. But for me, an unconventional background, perhaps not the classic. So a working class kid. And I would say that the path from coming, you know, the initial first 10 years spent in a very violent housing project in Scotland. And here I am sitting talking to you in the garden of Maison Blanc Bleu on the wonderful and luxurious island of St. Barts. And I would say that that path was formed by a combination of serendipity and by the unique force of my character and my nature. And perhaps at a very early age, it was recorded that I was one of life's warriors by school teachers, etc. And I'd like to think that, again, with serendipity, I found a career as a global macro speculator, which coincided with that unique talent to worry. I've often said that I would, in the course of running the Eclectica, the now defunct Eclectica Macro Fund, that I would hear voices in my head, which is to say a combination of reading and reading with a very Catholic and eclectic taste. I would encourage any younger members listening to this not necessarily to devote all of their reading to the dry textbooks of finance. Goodness, that would be awful. But certainly go searching in terms to hear about the character of market participants who have set themselves apart and distinguished themselves. But also, I wonder over the course of this hour, I'd imagine that I will drop lines from the book which is captivating me just now, which is the Tibetan book of Living and Dying, and this wonderful insight, an insight that perhaps I've gained even more recognition of over the course of this summer, the notion of impermanence, that there are many conceits in modern life, but one of them would be the notion of permanence. And I've gone to town quoting from the book, saying that if you believe in permanence, then you're effectively attempting to lick honey from the razor's edge, which is to say that if you're still committed to risk markets and Fed puts and the entire, let's call it 50 or 60 year era of financial, I was going to say management, I fear I've got to say mismanagement by those that we elect to run our affairs, then beware, because it's a profoundly dangerous moment, I think, an historic moment, but more of that later. So yeah, I find myself engaged in Edinburgh. I then moved to London. I had the great fortune of working with one of the first European side macro funds. And in 2005, I took my existing hedge fund and I launched it independently with my own management company. And that hedge fund, I'm very proud to say, secured tenure. You can find more details on that on the Wikipedia page where we've published the last full audited investor letter. So you can see all of the returns. And what you will find is that the nature of my investment was to produce an independent, very low correlation set of returns. My task, my endeavor, was not to beat the S&P. And people kind of forget that. I'm commonly dismissed when people consider my, again, either erratic or eclectic, but very much undiversified, uncorrelated set of returns, which were positive to the tune of a positive carry of, let's say, 7 or 8% over that tenure, but clearly left behind by the beta of the S&P. So that's me. We closed the fund in 2017. I've been developing luxury real estate on the island of St. Barts. And since the emergence of the awful pandemic, as people rushed indoors and we encouraged distance, I found I wanted proximity. And so ever since, I've been more of a financial commentator. And weekly, I produce a podcast under the name The Asset Capitalist, which is there to kind of challenge and take on the intelligentsia, which I have a very dim view of.
As you talk about your tenure running Eclectica, I can't help but think about that period from 2005 to 2017. So 2005, 2006, the VIX is below 10, credit spreads have narrowed to all-time tights. And by 2008, the VIX is at an all-time high. Then you have the sovereign crisis in 11 and 12. And then, you know, you have China in 2015, that big risk off. And then by 2017, the VIX basically makes a new all-time low. So these cycles of market prices, both extremely low and extremely high, are certainly notable. And over the course of your tenure running Eclectica, you had to deal with both. You talked about global macro investing. And as the UK is up against something that's pretty unique here and seems kind of dangerous to me, it's hard to get away from, not to say that they're similar, but it's the 30-year anniversary of the Soros confrontation with the Bank of England, September, I want to say 15th of 92. And it seems to me, and I wanted to get you to reflect on this, because when you talk about independent returns, uncorrelated returns, oftentimes those have some overlap with being long vol, playing for some sort of explosive return and effectively finding a mispriced or underpriced tail. That's what Soros did. That's what John Paulson did in 2005 and 6 with subprime. And so I'm just curious if you could just talk a little bit more about your investing philosophy when it comes to independence, uncorrelation, and also finding maybe these tail outcomes that might have been overlooked by markets.
Yeah. Okay. So you're right in that in trying to produce a discrete set of uncorrelated returns, you find yourself more than periodically attempting to be long volatility. So again, if we take a step back, the majority, I would say 90% of active and obviously passively managed money is short volatility. And being long volatility is almost akin to being a short seller. There are not many short only funds, just like there are not many volatility funds, because it's an unnatural form of investing, because equities and other asset classes are deemed to be risk assets. And you receive a risk premium, most evidently via the dividend payments on equities. And that's a turbocharge to any subsequent returns. You know, the risk premium and plus the beta in a bull market defines the reputation, deserved or otherwise, of many. You're denied that. The challenge is that market makers, your counterparties, your participants in this largely zero-sum game, no one sells you spot volatility. Trying to buy volatility typically involves paying a substantial premium to where it trades presently. And therefore, just to break even, you need the status quo to break. And very rarely, it does break, but periodically. And I think we can count to like maybe no more than six rather intense moments over the course of the last 20 years. But if you think of 365 days, 52 weeks in a year, multiply that by 20, that's a lot of penury, if you will, for someone stepping outside the norm. And then allied to that, 20 years ago, the Bank of Japan introduced quantitative easing, subsequently followed by all of the major global central banks. Now, I'm very poo-faced or dismissive with regard to what quantitative easing actually does. But you know, there are three forms of money. There is pure public money, which is a central bank creation via the addition or withdrawal of bank reserves. Whether it's actually money actually is dependent on the behavior of the private commercial banks and how they react to the Fed expanding their reserves or taking their reserves away. The history of quantitative easing has been one which I think exposes the fact that it's been rather muted owing to a lack of willingness on the part of the commercial banks to actually take those bank reserves and do anything substantial in the real economy with them. I think they've come to resemble laundromat tokens. The other form of money is, let's call it semi-public, semi-private, which is the bank deposits onshore in the United States, which since 1933 have been subject to a 100% state guarantee in terms of the return of capital. And again, there that you have the Federal Reserve acting as effectively a bank regulator and trying to nudge via the change in overnight interest rates and trying to nudge again the behavior of private commercial banks. The central bank is presently nudging, I think, as you noted in your introduction, 2 years at 4%. But again, it is beholden upon the private sector's reaction. And the 10 years at 4%, which is to say the curve is flat, which would suggest, again, that the omnipotence of the Federal Reserve is being called into question by the enormity and by the thought process of private markets. And then finally, which is really the elephant in the room, we have pure private money creation, which largely I think we could ascribe to the Eurodollar system, which is effectively, as an example, a French bank can lend to a bank in China and in the process of deploying or the swapping of what's deemed to be safe collateral, you know, collateral, and collateral largely takes the form of US Treasury bills, if you will, is the gold of the 19th and the 20th century banking system. And of course, it's not as scarce as gold once was. In the housing debacle of the early noughties, what we discovered was that that third form of money actually is a challenge, more than a challenge. It kind of reveals the lack of state sovereignty over money creation. We found that the lenders to the US housing market back then were overwhelmingly overseas banks and largely banks located in Europe. So I kind of want to say that what I want to say, I want to say that the US, if you will, which sits like the king or the queen at the apex of this immense and powerful financial triangle, it has no peer. And yet I want to say to you, it has no monetary sovereignty in that it has no control over the monetary creation within its own national borders. So we live in a peculiar time. Now, back to that quantitative easing, which I've suggested has been largely a redundant exercise in the nudging and the changing of commercial banking engagement with the real economy. If I was to ascribe it a role, I think the most profound role was that it lowered volatility for all risk assets. And that was a profound unpleasantness for an uncorrelated hedge fund, macro hedge fund manager like me. I remember, let me give you an example. I remember getting very, very excited. I'd read a wonderful, wonderful piece, which will be preserved in the annals of time for its astonishing insights, by Chris Cole, the famous vol trader. His business is called Artemis. And it was attempting the impossible. It was trying to attempt to determine what happened to volatility. Let's not get caught in the micro of it. But what happened to equity volatility during the horrors of the Weimar, the German hyperinflation of the early 1920s. And he concluded that volatility actually rose as equity prices rose. And equity prices were rising because they were a real asset. They were a means of seeking to protect yourself. If you were in a fixed return bank deposit or a government bond, then you'd have no option but to jump into the equity market. So equity prices were surging in local currency terms. And that's a great challenge to the world that we've come to understand post the October crash of 1987, which has largely created the notion that equity volatility, or the expectation that equity volatility can only rise with these abrupt and sudden lurches to the downside in equity prices. But that is not a law. It's not a thermodynamic law, and it certainly doesn't apply to any other asset class. And as I peer at the dim and the distant and the fearful future, and thanks to Chris's paper, I'm still convinced that we may see a period in the not-so-distant future where equity prices might surge and volatility might surge. So you can imagine I was fascinated with the election of Abe, the departed. I mean, Abe has been assassinated, but back then his three arrows. And his three arrows and his purported economic revolution, like kind of Reagan Thatcher for a Japanese audience, was met with such glee and a surge in equity prices that actually we saw this peculiar incident where volatility rose with asset prices. And so I put together, my team and I put together what, if I was to challenge myself, was a profoundly complex trade, but is unavoidable at times just owing to this dilemma that vol is always being sold to you at a substantial premium. And therefore, you kind of have to do much to chip away at the expense of that volatility. The profound convexity that was anticipated by our models left me like a kid at Christmas Eve waiting for Santa Claus to deliver presents. And I tell you that story because It was a bad trade. Why was it a bad trade? It was complex, and it was a bad trade because we lost money on it. We were wrong. Now, why were we wrong? Because the kind of rule that should have been scotched to my computer screens, my Bloomberg screens, was with quantitative easing, there is only one certainty. Risk asset volatility falls. And of course, that trade was inherently very, very long volatility. And therefore, it was very, very costly.
It's a fascinating thing to think about the impact of QE. And I've always argued that these are supposed to be economic policies with economic outcomes, stimulate the economy, help push inflation from a, I don't know, below target level to on target level. But the way in which they operate through financial markets, both through the vol channel, through the way in which market participants lean into carry or forced into vol selling profiles, I found to be pretty dangerous. And it wasn't a surprise that by early 2018, that VIX product blew up after a 50-year low in volatility in 2017. And so it seems to me that these central banks, in trying to help describe or help plan out the future for investors, this philosophy of transparency sometimes backfires. And I think maybe this is where we can pivot to the here and now, because I know you've got lots of thoughts. And of course, we're having this conversation at an especially fraught time for markets. It'll be great to get your thinking. Maybe we can start here with COVID and just the market aspects of COVID, the policy response to COVID. You know, here in the US, there's not a lot of things that bring bipartisan support. It takes a massive global pandemic to get both the right and the left to sign on to something. And it happened. That's how desperate the politicians were to try to do something. And of course, alongside the fiscal response was just a giant monetary response around the world. Again, not here to argue that they shouldn't have done it. It was obviously very large, as it probably needed to be. But that was in a lot of ways a pivot for so many things. It was coming after the deglobalization with China had already started. So maybe start there, because I know you do a lot of thinking on China as well. Talk to us about how the pandemic and the policy response to it have played a role in getting us to this spot here. How has your thinking evolved over the course of the last, let's call it 30 months? And just we'll use that as a way to talk about the here and now as well.
Yeah, let's go Shakespearean. I find the question of to be or not to be in today's markets has very much been a question of to think or not to think. And that's been leveraged by the Federal Reserve. Again, I maintain that there is an inherent lack of economic substance, and it's more the rhetoric of political economy, borrowing from the wizard's powers of the Emerald City in The Wizard of Oz, that actually, when you pull back the curtains, you think, wow, I bought a turkey here. And what we may be seeing is those curtains being pulled aside. And it may be that the UK is the first instance of getting a glimpse at that. The perception of quantitative easing is that it's a revolution in monetary thinking. It is inherently an easing of monetary policy. Again, this is the perception I'm trying to address. So a very loose monetary policy. And yet, and where your COVID question becomes very, very relevant, is that since the mystique, and I think in some respects, a grotesquely misunderstood intervention of Paul Volcker back at the end of the 1970s, central banks, by and large, have failed. I can't say since the early 1980s. Forgive me. I guess I'd have to say from about 18 years or so. Previous history, that central banks have actually failed in their inflation mandate. You know, they were given their independence, and to gain that independence, they were asked to deliver a mandate of 2%, no more than 2% inflation. That was deemed to be some kind of grease that would oil the engine, and the engine of US prosperity via the relentless march of GDP, which in the 30 years leading up to the catastrophe of the housing bubble, had produced 2.8% compound annual growth. But for 18 years, central banks have consistently failed to get inflation 2%. Then you have the COVID, and two prominent things happened. The Federal Reserve, its leaders were very provocative in their language. They actually went out of their way to address, if you will, Joe Public, if that's not condescending, on daytime television, not wearing suits, not wearing ties, open neck shirts. You know, I'm not the guy from the Fed. I'm your friend. And I'm here to tell you that we're printing money. He actually said, Powell said that. And if he was printing money, he would be subject to a federal investigation, which I think he might have to serve prison time because it is explicitly prohibited in the Federal Reserve Acts of the mid-1930s. And yet he said it, and he said it again in this role of not jester, but in terms of the magic wizard of the Emerald City, that he had to convince people who were legitimately very fearful of the economy and their livelihoods. And he had to say, I got your back. But the commitment to that language, I think, was an error. And then secondly, the pandemic was global. It was profound. The magnitude was enormous. The magnitude almost extended to a short but brutal global warfare, if you will. The fiscal reaction. Again, I want to say very little of the $5 or so trillion of what I would call laundromat tokens, which were produced in this by this rhetorical Fed. But the direct helicopter printing of money, the transmission of money into the hands of households with the explicit command to spend it, when two-thirds of the economy, which is to say the service economy, was still shuttered by the pandemic, just created the most profound imbalance of demand versus supply. And in private markets, that has to be regulated by higher prices. Now, that has been compounded by the, heavens, I struggle for adjectives to describe my disdain for a generation of European politicians, which largely denied the European state today of sovereignty. I believe sovereignty is made clear, again, not actually by monetary coinage, but I would say by energy. And independence of energy creates a superpower. And the European state's ambition has very much been the rug's been pulled from under it because of its failure to achieve a sustainable, independent form of energy supply. And of course, that has resulted in a profound and what will be, I could say, almost a permanent plateau, permanent only in the context of today's day traders, but permanent in the context of, you know, 20 plus years necessary to address the supply reforms to once more make the European sovereign have an independent energy supply. So the result, of course, is the inflation. And the inflation is a reality of today, but there are profound fire breaks in the capital markets. There is a reason why the US has not been subject to the ravages of the Weimar hyperinflation and why it's been subject more to peripheral nations. And the reason, by and large, is the profound and outsized magnitude of capital markets, treasury markets and commercially sensitive credit markets are multiples of the size of the economy itself. And at the first whiff of trouble, those rates reset, and they can reset dramatically. And as evidence, you know, we're seeing now US mortgage rates 30-year reaching 7%. The rate of change is historic in its intensity. And that is the private market firebreak, or one of those firebreaks. The political economies of Venezuela et al. Have found themselves subject to hyperinflation because they don't have capital markets of that great magnitude to regulate their behavior. So I believe, and I am, I don't know if I'm a lone voice, but I'm certainly subject to ridicule. Yesterday, I was subject on Twitter to someone making a very unkind comparison with Larry Summers. Larry wasn't the former Treasury Secretary for the US. I've disdain is a word one perhaps, I use perhaps too much, but I have disdain for tenured economic professors because they're never subject to feeling the pain of the consequences of bad decisions. Those bad decisions are largely felt by the electorate. But it is statistically correct to say that Larry Summers did warn ahead of time that we would have the inflation of 2022. I would accord the inflation of 2022 to the inflation of 1948. US CPI was pretty much touching 20% as we came out of the Second World War. And again, we had a profound imbalance of supply versus demand. Supply was still orchestrated for the war effort. And we had the returning G.I. Joes and a great desire to make babies and a great desire to spend money in the manner that we've seen people do so. Here I am in this fantasy island in the Caribbean. And believe me, after COVID and being kind of compounded in your homes, people have come to this island, they've spent money and they've had a great time. So kind of G.I. Joes and post-pandemic. But we don't talk about the legacy. We don't talk about the hyperinflation. We don't even talk about the 20% inflation of 1948 because the firebreaks held. And moving forward, the inflation rate decelerated. I mentioned one firebreak. The other firebreak is that the high prices are creating a profound and necessary reduction in discretionary spending. The high prices are typically found in items such as filling your car up with gas, cooling your house or heating your house, depending on the season. And these are not discretionary. And so instead, you find that US receipts for visiting the cinema are something like 60% below where they were in 2019, you know, the year before COVID. I could cite many examples of that. You find that mileage, US automobile travel, is, I think, below where it was in June of 2020 when we were all required to stay at home. So you can see visible evidence of restraint. And that's why I believe the bond markets are contesting the duration of the inflation of 2022. But you know, that still remains something that the future has to reveal. It's speculation on my part and others.
You alluded to, I think you might not have used the word asymmetry, but I think you kind of alluded to it in terms of how market prices can just gap out. They can just suddenly move in ways that are typically on the unkind side of things. And you know, I think Friday was a turning point. You know, as of Friday, the S&P for the year was down 23-odd%. That's a pretty vicious drawdown. If you put it in context, that's a whole lot. But realized volatility in the S&P was about 23-24%. So that's high, but it's not financial crisis. It's not pandemic type of violent moves. And there wasn't this sense that market prices could become the problem. And, you know, if you think about the great financial crisis, the Eurozone sovereign crisis, the market prices were the problem. The only way to win on this was to, you know, to get Ireland's sovereign CDS spread down or France's CDS spread down. Or in the case of 2008, it was mortgage-related risk premium had to go down. And I'm just curious if you could reflect on these last couple of days with the moves in long-dated gilts, the big move down in the British pound. Do you think we're in a situation now where these market prices become front and center and almost become potentially unmanageable for policymakers? How do you see what the last couple of days implies?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been very vocal on Twitter and other platforms. I was a macro fund that made 33% in the calendar year 2008. That's not bragging, but I think it has to be. It is to demonstrate credentials. I made 50% in the month of October 2008. And therefore, I thought it was, you know, there was a utility in me being out on tapes and saying, I actually fear where we are now more than I fear back then. I also wanted to reflect on something you said about where realized and indeed implied volatilities in terms of S&P are trading. I just recorded a podcast with Jem. Is it Jem Carson? You know, at Jam Croissant, who's a notable contributor to Twitter and indeed runs money in the fashion that I once did. And we're not hearing about it, but there is being a massacre. It's not a massacre of the innocents. It's a massacre of those who should know better, but the long vault communities. So again, long vault is typically a hazarded operation, but periodically, like you say, Friday markets slide and boom, it's payback. These guys have been, guys, girls have been wiped out. There's been, really wiped out. And newspapers, financial newspapers are always full of nonsense, but they're quoting the huge surge in put option buying and trying to be contrarian. But when you speak to your masters of that universe, such as that Jam Kwason, he's saying the market is on a knife edge. And if it's pushed, and events in Europe and elsewhere could provide the push, it's like, to your point, we lose control because it's fear. You know, it's fear of the repo man who comes in and he touches your shoulder and you got no choice. You got a closed position. So I think we're close there. Let's go further. I think today perhaps may be more significant than Friday because it's chipping away. The central banks are losing control of their rhetorical narrative. You know, QE, we do QE. And effectively, it's like cutting rates when we're constrained at the zero line of rates. We create bank reserves. Quantitative tightening, of course, the Fed is hiking rates. And so at the same time, it's doing tightening because that's an additional form of rate hiking. And then you have in the UK, the Bank of England has had to change vault fast. It was committed to raising interest rates and it was committed to quantitative tightening. But now is doing quantitative easing again. What is quantitative easing? You know, and why would you do quantitative easing? Why would you do effectively a rate cut in their preposterous language when you're committed, the expectation is rates will go from 2.25 to 6% over the course of the next year. Suddenly it's like, guys, what have you been drinking? You're suddenly off message. You know, it's like there's a crackle in the mic. I'm not making sense of what you're saying. And slowly but surely, the facade of all the nonsense of central bank rhetoric over the last 20 years is there to come unstuck. Now, what they're actually admitting to is my point to you about monetary sovereignty. Again, the elites of this world, the Larry Summers and the Bernankes and whatever, they won't tell you in person, but when they meet privately, they talk about the Treaty of Westphalia, a territory, I think, in northern Germany. And the Westphalian, there's a Westphalian conception of money. So the treaty back then was, I mean, back then, 1648, right? You know, I could stretch my bandwidth. It was the end of the 30-year war. I think there were like 194 states and dignitaries that had to sign up to that torturous agreement. Why were there so many? Because it was a religious conflict. The attempt to impose Catholicism over a largely Protestant nation. That failed, and that was recognized in the Westphalian. Why are we talking about the 30-year war of the 17th century? Because that is the terminology used to assume that monetary sovereignty, then you control coinage, and it's like within your national borders. And the UK, again, is actually in its acts, is revealing that that's just nonsense. Why are they willing to buy British gilts and subject themselves to my ridicule, to the inconsistency of, on the one hand, speaking one side of your mouth, saying, I'm raising rates, and on the other hand, I'm not raising. What are you doing? You know, why? It's collateral. So again, it's back to that. The third and the most relevant tenet of money, which is, we said, public money, which is these tokens of banking reserves. We went to semi-public-private, which is insured bank deposits. But now we're now looking at the footprint of the elephant. And the elephant is the pure private money, which is created by using the collateral of safe. I'm inverting with my fingers the commas, but safe government sovereign bonds. And the sanctity of gilts is being called into question. And therefore, the repo man is bearing down on UK banking institutions. It would be interesting. I don't have access to a Bloomberg, but I'd be very interested to be looking at five-year CDS swap spreads on the major UK financial institutions. I imagine they're beginning to show stress because banking counterparties. See, this is the Eurodollar market. The Eurodollar market, you're allowed to create an infinite amount of credit, you know, way beyond anything that the Federal Reserve would permit via Basel III et al. You are able to contravene that as long as your banking peer group, your banking counterparties, have full confidence in your P&L and what you're doing. When that breaks, the whole system breaks. Okay. And so the UK is desperately trying to kind of say, gilts are safe, Mr. Repo Man, give us time. Now, we mentioned, hey, listen, in 2008, the global banking community was bankrupt. In March 2009, Citigroup, I think, traded at, I think, $9, which was the same price it had prevailed at in the mid-1970s. And if it was $9, it was $9 too high because it was effectively bankrupt. That's what it was. Only a matter of days, weeks before the Federal Reserve committed itself to quantitative easing. You know, we were confronted with a 1930s scenario where the global banking system would go bankrupt. The Federal Reserve prevented that from happening. But why did it go bankrupt? It went bankrupt because of a corruption in what was deemed to be safe collateral. I think we're more accepting of the notion of US Treasury bills, British gilts. I'd have been willing. At the top of the channel would be German bunds. Why the top? Because they have a legal rule to run a balanced budget. They can't run deficits. But that means the issuance of bonds is comparatively small.
Right.
But the actions of the European Central Bank from 2012 have been such that they persuaded the risk community that Italian bonds, which we refer to the 10-year, we refer to as BTPs, that they could be thought of as German bonds. And so in 2008, the bankruptcy of the global system was a function of using mortgage-backed securities, the notion that a portfolio of geographically diversified housing mortgages was actually less risky than the US Treasury market because we had never, you know, we had 100 years of data, something like the 120 years of US equity data. Prices always go up. You know, I had that debate with someone quite recently. There was a conceit whereby no one said, but what if there is a nationwide house price decline? The conceit was to say it can't happen. And so 2008 was a crisis of collateral, whereby the repo man said, I don't want your mortgage-backed securities. I want treasury bills, short-duration treasury bills. And the question is that happening again? I thought that it would be the Italian, and indeed it is, the Italian bonds are deemed to be kind of bull market collateral. And as we shift gears into the impending catastrophic economic recession, which is all around us, they're no longer, if you will, regarded as money. You know, government bonds are money today. You know, if you are a financial speculator looking to speculate with leverage, with willing counterparties, you need government bonds as collateral. And I think at the margin, Italy will be rejected. There's been political change there. Again, a further swing to whatever the right means. I mean, the right just seems to be the opposition to the European core. But now on top of that, you have British gilts being called into question. If we go further out, the swoon in the Japanese yen, the unwritten story is that Tokyo and its enormous banks are just a huge collateral warehouse for creating credit into China. And those Japanese banks, in furnishing and in monetizing the gains from that credit operation, have found themselves short dollars and short collateral and long commercial risk in China. And people are reducing their exposure. And that is why the yen is down 21% versus the dollar this year.
When you look at the speed of the crash in the UK gilts market, I'm reminded of this old saying, price is the only fundamental. And I think we live in this incredibly financialized world. And I'll channel a little George Soros reflexivity because it's, to me, a cornerstone of how to think about modern markets, which is prices are a cause, not an effect. Prices cause entities to have to act. And of course, with the BOE, this version of QE is not the kind of Fed 2014, 15, 16 version of QE. This is emergency QE. And I'm not sure what else they're supposed to do. You're effectively a buyer of last resort, but it's obviously extremely it's an uncomfortable place for markets to be. As you talk about Japan, and this is where I wanted to get your thoughts on China, because you brought this relationship in terms of Japan funding lots of what's going on in China. You've dropped an 8-minute, well-produced YouTube video talking about your current thinking on China. It's interesting, Q, versus, let's say, 2015 and early 2016, people like me were drawing corollaries between CNH and CNH Vol versus the VIX. There seemed to be a very direct feedback loop there. And then it kind of went away for a while. There was less talk about that channel. And so the Chinese currency is, just like all the other ones, weakening versus the dollar. You've done a lot of work on the Chinese currency. I'd love for you to talk about your current thoughts there, and then just maybe to broaden out the potential broader implications in terms of spillover or just where you see things going from that perspective.
So first and foremost, I feel like an ass talking about China, because in 2011, I raised about $100 million in one of these special purpose vehicles, which then was leveraged 10 times. And you mentioned Soros. I could have made $1 million. I could have. I should have. Of course, I didn't. Should my expectation back then that China really take on a, like, fall over an economic cliff and have a major retracement. That didn't happen. And I kind of jokingly refer to the Chinese zodiac, which has the same number of characters and what have you. But whereas our system of examining heavenly bodies and the movement of heavenly bodies is regulated by the Earth's passage around the Earth, which, as we know, takes a year, that passage in the Chinese system takes 10 years. And if you had 10 years, I first and foremost, I don't describe myself as a value or a growth investor or all of these particular silly silo names. But if you want to give me a silo, my silo would be, I'm a time investor. I try and conceive of contentious posture, which could go on and become the predominant thought belief of markets. But I'd give myself 2 years, and I failed within that window. But if only I'd known about the zodiac, then who knows? I certainly think all the reasons which validated that trade back then are even more pronounced. What has changed between then and now? China has the top tick on its residential property market was $90 trillion. I mean, should I say that again? $90 trillion. Chinese economy, I think GDP is actually inflated by the predominance of fixed capital formation by the public state, namely bridges and all these wonderful things, these modern highways, modern infrastructure, wonderful things, but things which will never, seemingly, and certainly in our lifetime, will the utility function of moving citizens on comparatively modest income levels will never be such that it will pay a return on the cash investment, which is to say, you're talking about net present values of minus 50% plus. So I think Chinese GDP is overstated. I think its growth rate has been overstated, that they've chosen growth at the expense of wealth. And I think we can say that definitively because we've got a long stock market record, which the stock market does not corroborate the phantom growth in that the stock market has been very mediocre. And you can't even rely upon any appreciation of the currency because the Chinese don't really permit for it. So what's changed has been, this tripping dilemma thing, states can only choose two of the following, the fixed exchange rate, capital mobility, autonomous monetary policy. They've had pretty much a dirty fixed exchange rate. Question marks on the autonomy of the monetary policy. I think the monetary policy has been hobbled by the politics of the Chinese Communist Party, that they foolishly associate GDP growth as the means to ensuring the permanent duration of that political system. And one third of GDP growth was emanating from the construction of these negative NPV road, rail, airport investments and the construction of residential property. And so they look the other way and they're now very vulnerable. Why are they vulnerable? They're vulnerable because, I mean, I said this very bold thing about the US having no monetary sovereignty. Neither does China. And I say China's in an even worse position. There is just a profound nonsense that China, the bank sector, is state-owned and therefore everything can be swept under the carpet. The naivety of that is beyond comprehension. At the margin, like I said, I think close to the introduction, we live in a world where a French bank operating in London will make a loan to China because the Chinese bank will produce collateral, which will persuade the bank to extend credit. They have no autonomy on their monetary sovereignty. And what's worse, that any collateral, previously, I think they were in a bull market. And what is a bull market? The pandemic created a bull market in the Chinese currency, because I think we started this guessing about the future course of the renminbi or the yuan. The yuan had been profoundly strong because with the rest of the world in lockdown, China was able to, its trade balance with the rest of the world was able to soar back to the kind of, I think, the 2008 record levels as a percentage of domestic GDP. And if we put its trade balance as a percentage of global GDP, it reached the almighty level of, maybe 1% doesn't sound almighty, but it's an almighty level in terms of historic data. And so macro mavens of my type, the flow just of the commercial hedging in the import-export market is you wouldn't touch it, which is to say that China's been very much the last, and the currency has been very much the last shoe to drop. It's only begun to weaken, I think, about 6 months ago. As people now look, and they look at, again, the impending economic crisis, which is going to engulf the world, and they say, ooh, being a creditor nation where your growth is dependent on the consumption of others in overseas domains is not really a very viable proposition. So their trade is likely to weaken. Their ability to manufacture GDP growth is now curtailed because there's no commercial, there's no residential construction. Their appetite for more negative NPV infrastructure investments, which load them with more and more debt, is now being deemed as imperiling the continuity of the CCP. So everything is colliding. And then the credit system is not willing to accept, if you will, mortgage-backed securities of Chinese property in the manner that it once was. So now the great fear is kind of the Aesop fables. You know, why did the scorpion, you know, zap the frog halfway across the river? Because that's its nature. And that takes me back to why on earth did Taiwan back in whenever, 1998 or so, why did it devalue? It didn't have the crisis of Indonesia, Thailand, et al., particularly Thailand. It didn't have that crisis. Why did it do so? Because it couldn't let the opportunity over its neighboring mercantilists, so let's call that the scorpion, it couldn't allow the other scorpions to benefit from the profound reduction in the effective exchange rate and therefore the advantage in overseas trade. It couldn't allow that to go unchecked, and therefore they would revalue downwards their currency in sympathy and to protect the mercantilist trade system. So when I see Japan, the 21% slide in Japan, when I see comments that the competitiveness of manufacturing in Japan is now superior to domestic Chinese. And when I think of what you do with that $90 trillion of excessive valuation in the residential property market, well, that's $90 trillion dollars. You can reset it by having a devaluation. Now, let's hope they don't do that, because that would rock the core foundations of our world. I formally describe that as waking up and finding yourself in a Mad Max world of profound devastation, be profoundly deflationary. And there would have to be a profound coming together of sovereign states to renegotiate and, by and large, to outlaw the mercantilist system, which doesn't belong in the 21st century.
The intersection between China and Japan doesn't get a lot of commentary, but as you think about that revaluation, and I'm going back to August 15, call that a quasi-repeg. It was a big deal for 3 weeks or so for the world and certainly for U.S. markets. But if this was the sort of thing where the tipping point was reached and China took a Taiwan-type 1998 approach, kitchen sinked it, and you say it's such a bad outcome, help us think through the, as you call them, deflationary implications of that.
So again, I deal in preposterous notions of what might happen. Why? Because no one else really does. So everyone's like logically bound to convention. And so when you're the now deceased Queen of England, etc., after the 2008 catastrophe, where I think she was on a visit to banking offices in central London, she said, why didn't anyone see this? So, which is a legitimate question. And they were like, well, you know, I saw it. You know, that was my stock in trade, absurdity. And the thing that I'm drawn to is, again, if we go back to Volcker and his actions, pretty much initiated the greatest bull market ever, the market in the risk-free US Treasury bond. Greatest bull market ever, because I think the 10-year went from yields greater than 16%. And during COVID, we struck 45 basis points. And so the implicit price rise that implies, plus the leverage, because the volatility of those instruments would have been at least 50%, if not greater, less than the corresponding volatility of a risk asset like equities. And, you know, so that Ray Dalio and Bridgewater over that period have secured on behalf of their clients the greatest cumulative P&L in the history of finance. And it's like, you know, did they do it or did the US Treasury bond market, you know, a bit of both, clearly. But it was kind of absurd in 1982 that the Treasury yields should be so high because, you know, if you had the faintest heartbeat, you could not fail to notice that with the Fed raising short rates to 20% in the worst economic drawdown of the post-Second World War environment, that inflation had actually peaked in 1980 and it was on the way down. And that wasn't a supposition, that was a reality. And I think you said it with your Soros and your reflexivity, price being a cause. Price is a cause of economic emotion, either fear or greed. And it was fear which led to the low price marks back then. So I would say that was absurd, those impossibly high treasury yields in the face of the certainty that inflation was being challenged and was on its way out. And therefore, I want to say that I believe in impermanence. Even the Buddha died, and even the greatest bull market will die at some point. And I think its death is perhaps close upon us, but its death will be a trial of absurdity. It'll be very hard to profit from. And so the conception that I have is that actually it does come to pass that the Chinese do a profound reval or deval, and that is just profoundly deflationary. You know, it's profoundly deflationary in terms of the real world. It absolutely destroys, again, this pompous term of the ordinary Joe. Destroys. And so I could that plus the fact that we have the Fed hiking, that plus the fire breaks in the capital markets, which have 7% mortgage rates and rising. And so we're going to have this, even without China, we're going to have this deep recession. If China devalues, so here we are with 10-year at 4%. I could conceive of that 10-year being back at 40 basis points. And then it would be the greatest short ever because finally we would see again the callow or the shallow nature of those who run central banks. And that put option that they proudly displayed in previous years, but they've been reluctant to discuss. What did you say? The S&P down 23% on the year. Believe me, that put option, I think, will be called into place. And maybe, if I'm really absurd, we might be able to conceive of right-hand volatility tail situations whereby surging equity prices owing to the Fed put create a dynamic where volatility rises. And so if I were engaged in managing money today, I would have a position, and the position would be nominally modest. I'd be asking for a 15,000 call strike with, I don't know, 15 or 20 years of life. Now, no counterparty should be willing to sell that because you won't be able to hedge it, if I'm right. And the losses could be just unimaginable, which is to say the gains unimaginable.
Let's finish with a couple minutes on your endeavors in financial podcasting and The Acid Capitalist. Tell us about what you're up to there and kind of where you're going with it.
Well, it remains to be seen. But when I reflected on the demise or the closure of my fund, I found that I missed more the engagement of my ideas, you know, putting myself out there to be mocked at, to be ridiculed at, but to have a good old argument and conversation with the wider community. So like today, yeah, I'm exercising my mind. I'm some of the things I've said with you today are things I've not said before. I'm practicing my thoughts. And that is joy. That joy is, that's an energy. Joy is energy.
This has been a pleasure. I'm glad we were able to connect, and I appreciate you spending the time. Our guests will enjoy hearing your very uncorrelated views and your both your retrospective on some of the recent history of market disruption and the current history of market disruption. So, Hugh, I want to thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Excellent questions. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.